In AD 30, 120 ordinary people sat praying in an upper room in a second-rate province of the Roman Empire. 3 centuries later, 10% of the Roman Empire would be their descendants. And a catechumen of their beliefs would sit on its imperial throne. And this would happen despite the fact that for much of that period, Christianity would be illegal and carry the death sentence for conviction of it. And hundreds of thousands would experience the ferocity of the Roman beast. Estimating the population of the empire in 300 at about 50 million, that's a middle-of-the-road estimate, at 10% of the total population, there were 5 million Christians by about the year 300. These were as likely Christians whose commitment was probably a far better quality than today's evangelicals. They were certainly superior to the numbers which poured into the church after Constantine's conversion, when it became popular to be a Christian, and in the language, inimitable language of John Bunyan, religion was wearing her silver slippers. Starting with 120 of the day of Pentecost, the church had to double in size every 20 years or less to have 5 million adherents by 300 AD. It's no wonder that the apologists turned to this remarkable growth in their defense of Christianity and its authenticity. Justin Martyr says about the middle of the second century, quote, "There is no people, Greek or barbarian or of any other race, by whatsoever appellation or manners they may be distinguished, however ignorant of arts or agriculture, whether they dwell in tents or wander about in covered wagons, among whom prayers and thanksgivings are not offered in the name of the crucified Jesus to the Father and Creator of all things." Half a century later, Tertullian addresses the heathen defiantly, "We are but of yesterday, and yet we already fill your cities, islands, camps, palace, senate, and forum. We have left to you only your temples," which we're emptying, of course. These and similar passages of Irenaeus and Arnobius are evidently rhetorical exaggerations. Origen is more cautious and moderate in his statement, but it may be fairly asserted that about the end of the 3rd century, the name of Christ was known, revered, and persecuted in every province and every city of the empire. Maximian, in one of his edicts, he was a persecuting emperor, says that almost all had abandoned the worship of their ancestors for the new sect. Of course, we ask what happened, and the answer is ultimately it had to have been the finger of a sovereign God and the hand of a risen Lord with the early disciples which wrought this. And yet, it also must be emphasized that there are other factors that God used. And a true Christian will wish to inspect this wonder of God more closely, this work of God, to use the language of the Bible, which will be studied by all who delight in his works. And this legitimate desire will in great measure be frustrated by the simple lack of historical materials, because only the tip of the iceberg can be seen in this growth, and that only sporadically. But we will look at expansion of the first century, expansion of the second century, and then some concluding remarks. Expansion of the first century. Our best source for this period is, of course, the New Testament. We assume that it records for us at least events of major importance, but this is not to say that it's concerned to give us even a summary of the major paths of expansion, certainly after the first few years. We know of Peter, Paul, and Pentecost, but we know practically nothing of the evangelism carried out by the rest of the 12 apostles. There is a late rumor that the 12 divided the world among them, which is probably false. There is a rumor that Thomas went east preaching in Persia and finally India, and that rumor may be true. There is good evidence for Peter laboring and dying with Paul in Rome around AD 64. There's good evidence for John laboring in Ephesus till the late 90s. This is all we have of the 12's missionaries endeavors. Acts 2, however, gives us some important information and tells us how many from many parts of the empire were there on the day of Pentecost, and no doubt some of them formed the basis for churches in different parts of the empire. And how we hear, verse 8, each in his own dialect, in our own dialect in which we were born, Parthians and Medians and Elamites and those dwelling in Mesopotamia, Jews on the one hand, and Cappadocians, Judeans on the one hand, and Cappadocians, Pontans, or people from Pontus, and people from Asia, Phrygians and Pamphylians, Egyptians, and parts of Libya, according, and that which is according to Cyrene, or Cyrene, and those dwelling in Rome, Jews on the one hand, and proselytes, Cretans, and Arabs. We hear speaking, them speaking the, in our own tongues, the great works of God. So there were all sorts of people there in Acts 2 from all over the empire. Jews, no doubt, primarily, or at least people who had adopted Judaism, who had been Gentiles. And then in Acts 8:4 and 11:19, there is allusion to the evangelistic endeavor of Christians after being scattered from Jerusalem. Antioch and Syria would become the forward base for what we might call Western gospel operations. Paul from there would travel and evangelize throughout Asia Minor, Greece, and then come to Rome. There's some interesting evidence for the early planning of Christianity at Rome. Acts 2:10 mentions visitors from Rome at Pentecost. There was a large Jewish colony in Rome, perhaps 10% of the population, some people say at this time. Romans 1:8 assumes a well-established church known throughout the world, and that epistle's date is frequently put at or around AD 57. In AD 49, Claudius, quote, "Because the Jews of Rome were indulging in constant riots at the instigation of Crestus," the Latin is impulsore, Cresto, "expelled them from the city. Since Crestus was pronounced like Christus, it may well be that these riots were, like many others, the reaction of Jews to Christian evangelism. Aquila and Priscilla were among the Jews expelled and were apparently already Christians," Acts 18:2. In AD 95, there's another interesting record of one Flavius Clemens who was purged under Domitian. Here's an interesting phrase, "for atheism and Jewish ways." Think about that, atheism and Jewish ways. Well, if he's Jewish, he wasn't an atheist. And if he was an atheist, he wasn't Jewish. Except in this sense, he did not believe in the Roman gods, and therefore he was an atheist. And later evidence points to his wife as the original owner of a Christian cemetery. And this is interesting for two reasons. One, it shows that Christianity had penetrated the upper classes. Flavius Clemens was actually Domitian's cousin. And two, the two sons of Clemens, who now disappear, were at the time the heirs of Domitian. A lot of the time, you know, the Roman emperors did not have sons, or their heirs were not their sons, but like their nephews. You say, why? Well, it might have had something to do with the fact that 14 out of the first 15 Roman emperors were homosexuals. At any rate, these two boys were the heirs of Domitian, and it seems that their father and mother, there's evidence that they had become Christians. Another interesting evidence of Christianity, the Alpha Paternoster Omega Square, I'll show you that later next week. I have it in an outline. Shows up in Pompeii in 79 A.D. The church of the first century, isn't that when Pompeii was destroyed by Mount Vesuvius, 79 A.D.? They probably found it when they were excavating Pompeii. The church of the first century was dominantly urban. It moved first into Jewish colonies, which would be urban, and used the synagogue to establish itself. The rural areas were the last evangelized. In fact, rurals were called, became known as the pagans. To be from the country was to be a pagan, because that was the last stronghold of paganism. Something of the success of Christianity and its expansion can be gleaned from Pliny's letter to Trajan in AD 112. He was governor of Bithynia in Asia Minor, near the heart of the area evangelized by Paul. And thus, though what he says probably is not true of every part of the Roman Empire, it is revealing. And I'm going to take the time to read Governor Pliny's letter to Emperor Trajan. "My lord, It is my custom to refer to you everything that I am in doubt about, for who is better able either to correct my hesitation or instruct my ignorance? Where I come from, we call that a bootlicker, but that's where I come from. I have never been present at trials of Christians. Consequently, I do not know the precedents regarding the question of punishment or the nature of the inquiry. I have been in no little doubt whether some discrimination is made with regard to age, or should we just kill them all, or whether the young are treated differently from the older, or whether renunciation wins indulgence, or if it is of no avail to have abandoned Christianity if one has once been a Christian, whether the very profession of the name is to be punished, or only the criminal practices which go along with the name. So far, this has been my procedure when people were charged before me with being Christians. I have asked the accused themselves if they were Christians. If they said yes, I asked them a second time and a third time, warning them of the penalty. If they persisted, I ordered them to be led off to execution, for I had no doubt that whatever kind of thing it was that they pleaded guilty to, their stubbornness and unyielding obstinacy, at any rate, deserved to be punished. Good night, you know. I don't know what this Christianity is, but it must be bad if it makes them that stubborn. Anyway, that kind of stubbornness needs to be punished anyhow. Whew. There were other afflicted with the like madness whom I marked down to be referred to Rome because they were Roman citizens. Later, as usually happens, this trouble spread by the very fact that it was being dealt with, and further varieties came to my notice. An anonymous letter was laid before me containing many people's names. Now you can see what's happening now, huh? Some of these denied that they were Christians or had ever been so. At my dictation, they invoked the gods and did reverence with incense and wine to your image, which I had ordered to be brought for this purpose along with the statues of the gods. They also cursed Christ, and as I am informed that people who are really Christians cannot possibly be made to do any of those things, I consider that the people who did them should be discharged. Others against whom I received information said they were Christians and then denied it. They meant, they said, that they had once been Christians but had given it up. Some 3 years previously, some a long time, longer time, one or two as many as 20 years before. All these likewise both did reverence to your image and the statutes of the gods and cursed Christ. But they maintained that their fault or error amounted to nothing more than this. They were in the habit of meeting on a certain fixed day before sunrise, and reciting an antiphonal hymn to Christ as God, and binding themselves with an oath not to commit any crime, but to abstain from all acts of theft, robbery, and adultery, from breaches of faith, from denying a trust when called upon to honor it. After this, they went on. It was their custom to separate and then meet again to partake of food, but food of an ordinary and innocent kind. And even this, they said, they had given up doing since the publication of my edict, in which, according to your instruction, I had placed a ban on private associations. So I thought it more necessary to inquire into the real truth of the matter by subjecting to torture two female slaves who were called deacons. But I found nothing more than a perverse superstition which went beyond all bounds. Therefore, I deferred further inquiry in order to apply to you for a ruling. The case seemed to me to be a proper one for consultation, particularly because of the number of those who were accused. For many of every age, every class, and both sexes are being accused and will continue to be accused. Nor has this contagious superstition spread through the cities only, but also through the villages and the countryside. But I think it can be checked and put right. At any rate, the temples, which had been well-nigh abandoned, are beginning to be frequented again, and the customary services, which had been neglected for a long time, are beginning to be resumed. Fodder for the sacrificial animals, too, is beginning to find a sale again, for hitherto it was difficult to find anyone to buy it. From all this, it's easy to judge what a multitude of people can be reclaimed if an opportunity is granted them to renounce Christianity. And this is Trajan's reply to Pliny. My dear Secundus, you have followed the correct procedure in deciding the cases of those who have been charged before you with being Christians. Indeed, no general decision can be made by which a set form of dealing with them could be established. They must not be ferreted out. They are charged and convicted. They must be punished, provided that anyone who denies that he is a Christian and gives practical proof of that by invoking our gods is to win indulgence by this repudiation. No matter what grounds for suspicion may have existed against him in the past, anonymous documents which are laid before you should receive no attention in any case. They are a very bad precedent and quite unworthy of the age in which we live. Those are really remarkable letters, aren't they? I mean, they're really remarkable letters, and they provide kind of really a deep insight into the, what would you say, the self-respect and yet the depravity of the Roman Empire. Unbelievable, isn't it? So much that could be commented on in those letters. Anyhow, they're one of our best sources, though, for knowledge of early Christianity after the New Testament. This letter was written in 112. Well, that brings us to expansion in the second and third centuries. And first of all, Palestine, where we must speak of the Christian mission to the Jews and its progress. Christianity made great strides among the Jews till around 50 AD. The book of Acts refers to this. That's clear. From 50 to 70, little progress seems to have been made. The opposition to Judaism, of Judaism to Christianity, was hardening as the nature of Christianity took clearer shape. And then we see the failure of the Christian mission. In AD 70, Jerusalem was destroyed and hundreds of thousands of Jews were massacred. Obviously, the Christians did not become Jewish partisans in this uprising, having been warned against it both by prophecy and precept. Rather, they fled from Jerusalem, being forewarned by Jesus' ancient prophecy and, we're told, a prophetic oracle of their own time. Christians did not ingratiate themselves to the Jews by claiming that this destruction was due to the martyrdom of James the Just in A.D. 62. The Jews really liked that. You know why you guys got slaughtered here? What happened? You killed James the Just in A.D. 62. That's what happened. Well, the Jews didn't like that much, of course. The essentially different character of Christianity was from Judaism became more and more clear. No doubt could have remained after the quelling of the Jewish rebellion. Yes, there was a second Jewish rebellion 65 years later under the one called Bar Kokhba. His name means son of the star and is a reference to Numbers 24:17, the messianic prophecy there. Bar Kokhba was put to death with other instigators of the revolt, including the intrepid Akiba, a rabbi himself. Later tradition loved to tell how he died at the time of the evening oblation, reciting the Jewish creed, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one," in prolonging the last word, one, the Hebrew, "Chad," as long as his breath remained in him. And he laughed amid his torments, they said, for as he fortified himself for the words, "Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, and with all thy might," he understood as never before how it was possible to love God with all his soul in the very moment of breathing it out. And now Jerusalem was rebuilt as a Roman colony, and the temple duly consecrated to Jupiter Capitolinus, an order which was to endure until the time of Constantine nearly 200 years later. The city was named Aelia Capitolina after the emperor's family. A name, his full style was Publius Aelius Hadrianus, and Capitolina after the Roman Jupiter to whom the new temple was dedicated. It was a completely Gentile city. No Jew was permitted to come near it. So fierce were the reprisals taken against the Judeans that the rabbinic succession was kept up with difficulty, and the rabbis granted their followers a dispensation from all breaches of the law except idolatry and fornication. But the reprisals came to an end with the death of Hadrian in 138. The ban on circumcision was relaxed by his successor, Antonine. The history of the Jews did not come to an end in Hadrian's time, but interesting as their subsequent history is, we cannot trace it further here. So after these two hopeless uprisings were savagely put down, Jewish hardness to the gospel was almost impenetrable. And sometime between 70 and 135, the benediction against the Minim, which was a name for Christians, was added to the Jewish liturgy. The Jewish mission of the church was effectually resisted. And then we need to talk about the demise of Jewish Christianity. Meanwhile, Jewish Christianity's influence and power was effectually broken by the mass uprooting of the Church of Jerusalem in AD 70 because of the Jewish rebellion. After AD 70, this segment of Christianity dwindled into insignificance, Much of the Jewish church was no doubt absorbed into the Gentile churches to which they fled. Distinctively Jewish Christianity drifted off into heresy. This group has been called the Ebionites. In reality, this name simply means the poor, a reference both to the poor who are blessed of the New Testament and to the poverty-stricken condition of Palestinian Christianity. Some Ebionites were basically Orthodox Christians. Others were really the descendants of the Judaizers, which Paul fought. They seem to have been Docetist, Monarchians, and Legalist. That is to say, they said Christ was only seemed to be a man. They denied the Trinity, were modalist or monarchians, and were legalist. Later history of Palestine. Palestine was such a background of radical Judaism, and then imposed paganism would be one of the last pockets of serious resistance to Christianity in the empire. Syria. This, of course, was the province which the Antioch, which was evangelized in Acts 7 and 8, and which sent out Paul in Acts, was located, the Antioch. It had many ethnic groupings, became one of the great centers of Christianity, remained so for centuries. Its early ethnic mix was a model of the reconciliation of men affected by the gospel. And this is an interesting comment by Green. Green says it was a church where an aristocrat like Manaen, an ex-Pharisee of the most rigid type like Saul, Barnabas, an erstwhile Levitical landowner in Cyprus, Lucius, a Hellenistic Jew from Cyrene, and Simeon the Swarthy, almost certainly an African, could all work together in harmonious leadership. The Bishop of Antioch emerged as one of the leading figures of the early church. Its school would have a great influence on the church's theology, advocating a literal exegesis opposed to allegorizing. By 380 AD, 60 years after the Constantinian succession, 50% of its population of 500,000 would be Christians. Italy. The strength of Christianity in Italy can be discerned from the fact that about 250, it contained approximately 100 bishoprics. Now, at this point, a bishopric, or the seat of a bishop, was not that he was over a whole diocese, a number of churches, but rather a bishop led a single church of good size. So if there were 100 bishops, there were 100 churches of good size in Italy. This number must have increased greatly in the second half of the third century with the surge of growth that happened there. Rome particularly was the center of a strong and widely respected church. This admiration was based on several factors. First, it could claim Peter and Paul as its early martyrs and leaders. Second, it gained wide reputation for its stand under persecution by Nero in the 60s. Third, it was rich and open-handed church. Since many Christians were very poor, it was widely thanked for its charitable giving. Fourth, it was located at the natural center of the empire. Fifth, with the population drift to Rome, its size was outstanding. The first kind of anticipation or shadow of later claims to primacy and supremacy was innocent enough in AD 95 or 6. The Clement of Rome, he was later called the Bishop of Rome, but was probably only at this time a leading elder in charge of correspondence, wrote to Corinth urging unity in that church. So claiming some right, at least, to exhort them. By 166, there were more Christians than Jews in Rome. We're told the Jews were a large percentage of the population, perhaps 10%. By the year 251, the church at Rome was large indeed. Chadwick records, by the year 251, the resources of the church in Rome had grown so much that it was supporting from its common purse not only the bishop, 46 presbyters, 7 deacons, 7 subdeacons, 42 acolytes, 52 exorcists, readers and doorkeepers, it should read, but also more than 1,500 widows and needy persons, all of whom were fed by the grace and kindness of the Lord. One source suggests that this would have necessitated a church membership around 30,000. Schaff quotes sources who estimate 50 to 60,000. Gaul. There is a possible reference to Gaul in the New Testament. I thought, when I read that in my old notes, I thought, wow, I thought Gaul was mentioned in Acts 2, but it's not. But in 2 Timothy 4:10, one of the variants there, which says, the text here says, Crescus went to Galatian, But in some ancient manuscripts, Galadion is Galion. In fact, Aleph and C it is, and that would mean in the Codex Sinaiticus, in its original reading, it reads Gaul and not Galatia. Anyway, the persecution of 177 under Marcus Aurelius shows the church already well established in Gaul, especially in the city of Lyon, where Irenaeus was bishop. The development of the church in Gaul exemplified several aspects of the spread of Christianity. One, the place of evangelism in the bishop's ministry. Irenaeus preached in Latin and Celtic in the marketplaces of the city. Two, the urban character of the early church. The church was strong in Lyon and other cities, but penetrated only a little beyond the valley of the Rhone. Three, the tendency of Christianity to spread along trade routes. The church in Gaul had close ties with Asia Minor. Irenaeus himself was from Smyrna, and that was because the natural trade routes led from Asia Minor up to Gaul. Spain. Question arises, did Paul found the church in Spain? As the New Testament might give us some reason to hope. A later tradition says that he reached the gates of the West, but the meaning of that phrase is unclear. Bruce says, I'm not going to read the entirety of this, there's no solid evidence that he was able to carry out his plan of evangelizing Spain. And there are some other off-the-wall traditions. Britain may be of more interest to us. Tertullian and Origen, around 200, speak of Christianity's spread to Britain. The earliest certain date of British Christianity is A.D. 314, at which time three British bishops from York, London, and Lincoln attended the Synod of Arles. This makes it probable that Christianity was widespread in that province. There isn't the idea that the army brought Christianity to Britain, but Bruce thinks that's not true. The army, Bruce says, brought Mithraism, solar monotheism. At this time, Christianity existed only in Roman society, was not known among the barbarians of Ireland or Scotland who were dominated by the Druids like that famous Druid, Merlin, right? Bruce summarizes the history of early British Christianity. The earliest certain date in the history of British Christianity is August 1, 8314. That's where there's that Synod of Western Bishops summoned by Constantine to consider the Donatist claim to represent the true Catholic Church in North Africa. Among the bishops who came to Arles for the Synod, three came from Britain, Arborius, Restitutus, and Adelphius. That such an episcopal delegation could be sent by the British Church to the Synod suggests that by this time Christianity had spread over a good part of the province. But of the beginnings and early growth of the British Church, we know almost nothing. Later, legend is very willing to fill up the gaps in our knowledge with stories about Joseph of Arimathea and other eminent representatives of the first generation of Christians, but real evidence is extremely slight. It's been frequently suggested that Christianity was introduced by the Roman army. Well, all the evidence at our disposal is against this. He says, in fact, quote, if there was, next paragraph, one Eastern religion more than another cultivated by the Roman army, in Britain as elsewhere, it was Mithraism and not Christianity. Mithra was the god of light and truth in Iranian mythology. His cult was introduced to the Romans toward the middle of the 1st century B.C., and by the middle of the 3rd century A.D., it had spread so widely that an impartial observer might have concluded that Mithraism and not Christianity would become the dominant religion throughout the empire. It envisaged the world as a battleground between light and darkness. Worshippers of Mithra must take part in this warfare in order to attain union with him. Those who did attain it, were purified by mystic rites in which he was to believe to escort them through the 7 planetary spheres to the highest heavens, where they might expect to live in eternal light. Mithraism made a special appeal to serious-minded men, and particularly to soldiers, as is perhaps natural when we consider the military language in which its principles were expressed. Three temples on Hadrian's Wall, in Mithraic inscriptions and symbols there and at York and other places in the north of England, indicated that it had its votaries in the Roman army in Britain. No such evidence exists for the knowledge of Christianity there, even in the 4th century. And he says, I'm not going to quote all of this, there was probably carried to Britain by ordinary people, traders from Gaul and other places. Let me see where we're at here. Okay. Just a couple more comments. My voice is giving out. Egypt, Christianity was early planted in Alexandria and became one of the primary centers of Christianity, also the birthplace of the Arian heresy, as we're going to see. And then Roman North Africa, known as Numidia today, then, and today as Tunisia, Algeria. This was one of the strongly Christian areas early on. Carthage was a center. Among the bishops of Carthage were two famous ones, Tertullian and Cyprian. Something of the strength of Christianity can be seen in the fact that in 308, the schismatic Donatists, these are the schismatics now, not the Catholics, held a synod to which 270 bishops came from North Africa. The church here spoke Latin, and in fact used the oldest Latin translation of the Bible called the Atala. This translation was completed probably in the second century, although our earliest copy dates from the fourth century. The church was strongest in the Latins of North Africa. The openness may be due in part to the fact that the Roman population had been uprooted from Italy and would be ready to change and form new traditions, because they were all settlers transported over there after Rome defeated Carthage and the several centuries previous to that. I'm going to conclude right there before my concluding remarks, which are somewhat lengthy. So we'll do that for our first lecture next week and move on to the whole matter of the pre-Constantinian persecution and then the post-Constantinian expansion. And that'll really complete, for the most part, our church historical studies of this of early church history. We'll begin to focus on more doctrinal issues in the lectures after next week. Okay, questions? Going. Andrew.
I'm curious about the letter from Pliny to Trajan.
Mm-hmm.
Just where it says that the two female slaves were called deacons.
Mm-hmm.
Would you talk about that?
What would you like to know? Do I think they were literally deacons on a par with the male deacons? No. I do. My theory is, and I think it's supported by 1 Timothy 3, that there was a female auxiliary to the diaconate that in 1 Timothy 3 are actually distinguished from deacons because they're contrasted with the deacons. They're called the women instead of the deacons. And so I believe in the early church it was common for there to be a female auxiliary to the diaconate, and apparently in some cases that female auxiliary in a development, kind of natural although somewhat dangerous development of terminology, came known as diaconissa, the feminine version of deacon. That may sound like it's special pleading because I don't believe in female deacons per se, although I don't have problems with a female auxiliary like that, I think, which is assumed in 1 Timothy. But I don't think they hold the full office of deacon or are equal with deacons in their authority. So, and so often when deaconesses are talked about today, they are seen as equal to deacons in authority and office, and I don't think the New Testament supports that at all. In fact, I think the New Testament's against it. Having said that, we shouldn't be surprised by that kind of terminological development, because by this time in 112, not only are we referring to deaconesses, and remember, this is a Roman governor, too, but at any rate, we're referring to bishops as distinguished from elders. And so you had very early on some terminological developments that long-term would be very contrary to a New Testament ecclesiology. Thank you very much. Have a good drive home, Eric.
Thank you.